Hello, everyone. This is AC2GS. I would like to know if I'm coming through to the repeater. The All-Star link seems to be screwed up tonight. So are you able to hear me out there?
Loud and clear on both repeaters, K2GJE, over.
Okay, very good. We'll continue on this way. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 44 years, and every Sunday night we sit in front of our radio, and we chat with each other, and we exchange information with each other and learn from each other, and hopefully are entertained by each other. So once again, I thank you for coming this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. As always, I will drop and give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to contact me via email, that would be for mailbag questions or TechNet puzzles, or if you want to volunteer your expertise in a technical field that's in the news and we don't know that as much as you do, let me know, email me, and we'll set aside some time. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA space-related story, you can contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, as always, every week I collect a bunch of interesting articles and occasionally YouTube videos and put it on a link page and make it available to everyone, and this week is no different, so all you have to do to get it is to type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. We keep that page up forever and ever and ever. Also, if you would like to get into our chat room, sometimes it's busy, a lot of times it's quiet these days. You type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and if you want to have access to a internet audio stream of the technical net, and I keep it live the rest of the week so you can listen into the Glen Oaks repeater, you just have to type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a link to the Glen Oaks repeater. And as always, I like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has over a million visitors, and it has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who have passed through. They've either moved away or unfortunately become silent keys over the year, but their wisdom has been recorded in audio form. So take a listen when you have nothing better to do. So that's the usual links. Let me drop for a second, and I will return to tell you what we got planned for tonight. Okay, nothing particularly different than usual, a vanilla edition. We don't have any guest speakers. There's a couple of stories I'd like to talk about before we start the main segment, which will be questions, topics, and comments. Then, obviously, is the questions and the comments and the topics, and we would like people to hit the push-to-talk, give us their first name, their call sign, whether it's amateur radio-related questions or comments or technical and scientific. We accept both, but we would prefer the amateur radio stuff to go first since this is an amateur radio net. That should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul will join us, WS2N, he will give us the SpaceNet report. That will take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan if everything works out. This particular week, the question is not whether All-Star kicked me off, because All-Star didn't kick me on. So I'm actually functioning RF for a change, which is a nice change. Occasionally, the repeaters aren't quite up to South Brooklyn, but tonight, hopefully, they are, and there won't be too much noise in the background. So that's our plan for tonight. Let me drop, and I'll give you a couple of my little short stories here. Okay. A couple of things. Not really that interesting things going on in artificial intelligence, per se, the past week. You know, the same churning and churning and promoting and trying to get the, everyone's trying to get their first $1 trillion wealth. I will, though, tell you something that I noticed this past week that left me a little disappointed. I was thumbing through our club newsletter, the e-log, and I noticed that the people have decided to use to use ChatGPT to generate technical articles. Now, I used to write technical articles for the e-log. And, you know, they were somewhat labors of love, and it disappoints me that we're now giving it to a artificial intelligence. There's something in the newsletter that says that some people are kind of checking its work and tweaking and adjusting its output. But, you know, it's an AI article, and, you know, I don't really, I understand it's a fun toy to play with. It's a tool for some unfortunate people, but I don't know. It leaves me kind of blank. I can't get excited over what a machine thinks about radio wave theory and such. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see how this works out, but I didn't expect to read ChatGPT stories in the club newsletter. We'll see how it all goes. Let me drop for a second. I'll tell you something else. Okay, a week or two ago, someone mentioned that a 70-centimeter band was in danger. And that has to do with some company called AST Space Mobile. Apparently, they operate in Europe, and they use portions of the 70-centimeter band, 430 to 440 specifically. And they had filed a preliminary request with the FCC to extend their frequency allocation, which could have included 430 to 440, which was annoying to most of us. The good news is that this organization, this company, has filed their final FCC application, in which they removed the request for the 430 to 440 megahertz spectrum. So that risk to our 70-centimeter spectrum is now gone. So everyone celebrate. It was a close one, maybe, but we got our 70 centimeters without any kind of limitations. So those are the two stories that I wanted to discuss with you guys. If you want to make any comment about them now before we go to the usual questions, comments, and topics, feel free to hit that push to talk. Okay, then we will go to the questions and comments and topics. Preferably the first few, try to make it amateur radio related, but we will talk about any science and technology based topic that anyone wants to talk about. So hit those push to talks and give me your first name, call sign, and whether it's amateur radio related or science and technology.
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform Mobile.
Alex recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Julian Oscar.
Yes, what's your first name, sir?
Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Oscar, no traffic.
Okay. Anyone else want to put their name down?
Echo 2, Yankee Golf, Sam.
Sam recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down tonight? Okay, hopefully a little later on, so there'll be a few more people joining us, and they'll have some questions or comments. Alex, what can I do you for tonight?
I'm sure this has been answered over the years many times, but can you, in layman's terms, explain the difference in the use case for 2 meters, 70 centimeters, and either CB or 10 meters? I know, like, for AM radio goes really far, FM radio goes well through buildings, in that simple of a way. I can never seem to remember when to use which. 82 to you.
Okay. I don't find to be a significant real difference between 2 meters and 70 centimeters. They're both point to point. They don't propagate through sky waves. They go right through the ozone and out into outer space. So you pretty much have to elevate your antenna and have it be point to point with the other contact antenna. 70 centimeters have a little bit more path loss, so you, for the given same amount of power, you might be able to get a little bit farther with 2 meters than 70 centimeters. But again, it's all point to point. None of it is skywave propagation. They both pretty much, to a degree, go through some parts, you know, of some structures. Trees are kind of safe. Wet trees, you might get some attenuation loss. When you get to HF, it, of course, changes. The 10 meters is capable of skywave propagation. That's what gives it kind of the magic band qualities during the sunspot activities. It's very the sunspot activity usually, not this particular spring and summer, but usually give you great propagation. Whereas 70 centimeters, you might get some good propagation from thermal inversions from the weather, and that produces a refractive layer in the troposphere, which is below the ionosphere. And that's the mechanism that some people on the West Coast use to communicate using 2 meters to communicate with Hawaii. And on the East Coast, sometimes you can get into Europe. So that's kind of roughly the differences between the three. If anything didn't make any sense, feel free to ask.
Explain the Hawaii thing one more time, and also just if you're going to be, let's say, on a road trip with you in another car, would you use 2 meters, 70 centimeters, or CB? I guess GMRS is 70 centimeters, too, so that falls in near there, I think. Over.
Yeah, I kind of think in terms of ham radio. So I would easily go for either 2 meters or 70 centimeters. There's a lot more band space for 70 centimeters. So if you're having any kind of problems reaching the other person, or it's too active on the band there during the simplex, there's a simplex calling frequency for both 2 meters and 70 centimeters, and then theoretically you're supposed to move off of the calling frequency to a close by frequency, so as leaving the calling frequency open for the next guy. I've almost never heard that happen, unfortunately, locally. But, yeah, either 70 centimeters or 2 meters, whichever the two of you prefer, as long as you're, you know, relatively near each other, it shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I actually heard a guy doing parks on the air activation on 146.520, and I was like, this is the calling frequency for New York City. There's a ton of people here in this. But we'll see. I've certainly never run into not enough space on the 2-meter band for simplex. But thank you for the information, and that was helpful. 82 to you.
Yeah, it was almost saying it tongue-in-cheek, because, I mean, theoretically, there once was a time when the frequencies were packed, repeaters were very busy, simplex was busy. Nowadays, yeah, you don't really need to have such a wide bandwidth that 70 centimeters provide. But you also asked the question about Hawaii. Usually we're used to skywave propagation based on the refraction of radio waves through the activated ionosphere. The sun ionizes the ionosphere. The activated ionosphere produces a refractive quality to radio waves and refracts them back to ground, and that's where you get either one or two bounces across the world, and you get skywave propagation. If your frequency is high enough that it doesn't refract off of any of the ionospheres, it tends to go straight into outer space and is lost, other than in ground wave propagation. Now, there is a special case in which, rather than the ionosphere producing the refraction, thermal inversions, weather patterns, where there's the hot and cold layer of air kind of invert themselves because of the weather, produce a refractive tunnel in the troposphere. The troposphere is the lowest layer of the atmosphere. It's below the ionospheres, all of them, D, E, and F1 and F2. So under those cases, something like 2 meters will refract off of the troposphere and bounce up and down and get you as far as Hawaii if you're on the West Coast.
Is the thermal inversion predictable at all, or do you just have to roll the dice and go fishing and see if it ever occurs?
It's partially predictable. You know, it depends upon, you know, different weather predictions. They might say that there's a slight chance. Ultimately, it's more word of mouth. Guys just keep on the West Coast, keep trying, and eventually, if they do succeed, they post it on websites and such and spread the word for the West Coasters. But, yeah, it's nothing you can depend upon, unfortunately. It's not like the sunspot cycle where it's a strict 11-year cycle. It's just a randomness of weather patterns being in the right place at the right time.
Is that the same answer for FMDXing, where I think people just record the entire spectrum and then have their computer auto-tag the RDS data for the stations? That I'm assuming just look at Excel and see where they came from. But is this the same scientific answer as the Hawaii answer?
Which FM band are you talking about? Because FM is only a mode. You can, theoretically, there's nothing keeping you from doing FM on other bands.
Good point. I was referring to FM broadcast.
It might. I'm not really that familiar if people use the same tropospheric ducting to listen to distant FM broadcasts, but it might. It's not that terribly far away from the 2 meter frequency.
Got it. AMDXing is more my thing, because I'm impressed when I can hear Pittsburgh, not when I can hear New Jersey. But thank you for the information, and I'll send it back to Net, 82 to you.
Okay, very good. AM, if you're talking about AM broadcast, is a very ground wave propagation. It's one of the odd propagation modes that allow for Midwestern stations where the FCC allows them to use excessive amounts of power, and you can hear it on the coast. So that's a different, that's a planar wave type of ground wave propagation that's somewhat esoteric for other uses, but people have been aware of it since the 30s and 40s, and it was a well-known kind of DX mode for AM broadcast stations located in the Midwest, you know, Chicago and such.
Comment.
Yes, Jim.
KD2VHD. I think the conversation about the comparison of 2 meters and 70 centimeters isn't complete unless you consider the fact that the UHF band truly gives you a practical length antennas for portable radios. The other bands really don't. I think that's key. If that's what fits your use case, it draws you there. If it doesn't, then it's a like you said. That's just my 2 cents. Back to that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Potato, potato. I mean, a 2 meter operation, you need a quarter of the wave. So that's a foot and a half. So I don't really think there's that much difference between the minimum length for a quarter wave antenna for 2 meters versus 70 centimeters. I think they're both very easy to accomplish.
I think that doesn't account for the fact that some of us, most of us here included, don't mind being the odd duck in the room with a foot-long antenna sticking out of their pocket. The UHF antennas are very practical in the room if you're wandering around with the rest of the folks.
Okay. Again, 2 meter and 70 centimeter whip antennas come in different sizes, especially if they're loaded with little coils at the base. So again, I don't think it makes or breaks anything, but you know, I mean, everyone to their own.
Question.
Yes?
What's used for a moon bounce?
In the old days, a lot of hard work. Moon bounce was a specialty art. Dick A2RIW, I think, played around with it. We had a guy whose call sign ended in MB for moon bounce. He's now in, I think, South Carolina. There's old moon bounce and new moon bounce. Old moon bounce required multiple arrays of high gain Yagi. So in other words, you wouldn't kind of put just one Yagi up on your tower. You'd put an array of 3x3 or 3x4 or as many as you can stack up next to each other to improve the gain and focus of the directionality that you would then point to the moon. And then you needed a good linear amplifier. Dick K2RIW actually designed his own, I think it was called an open slot. And I've seen specs of it published in books on the subject. So you need a lot of power, and you need a lot of Yagis. Nowadays, you can get by on a lot less because we have Joe Taylor's below noise, low signal transmission algorithms that most people recognize as things like FT8. So there are algorithms out there that are designed to pick up the reflection even if it's below your noise floor using a bunch of interesting techniques that are related to computer sciences and such. So the modern day guys need far less power and they need far less Yagis.
Frequencies or what meters would you be using to attempt a moon bounce?
1 second. Okay, I got Rich on the phone, and apparently part of the network is down. The middle island. So I think he's having problems connect. Anyway, usually I think UHF is the frequency of choice. But you know, there's nothing inherently. You could probably get there using 2 meters, but it's just everyone kind of uses UHF, or at least that I've read.
Echo 2, Yankee Golf. May I change the subject to sunspots and the connection to radio propagation and also the difference between sunspots and solar flares and that effect on radio waves?
Sure.
So, what am I looking for? More sunspots or fewer sunspots?
Theoretically, you're looking for more sunspots. Sunspots send solar wind and radiation to the Earth and hit the ionosphere, and the low-density gas is ionized. The electrons are knocked out of it, and it leaves a state of ionized gas as opposed to regular gas, or, you know, that's another real state of matter. And it's once it's ionized, it's able to refract electromagnetic waves, which is what we like to do. It bends the waves back to Earth. Ordinarily, they take off at an angle that where they would go through the ionosphere into outer space, never to be seen by us again. If you ionize the gas at the right level, it refracts the electromagnetic waves back to the Earth and allows at least one bounce, in some cases two or three. So all things being equal, you want to have good sunspot activity. Even solar flares, the problem, unfortunately, as far as anyone could figure out, is in addition to that, there are geomagnetic storms going on, which interact with the magnetic fields on Earth and disrupt the structures of the ionospheres, especially the higher ones like F1 and F2. And so what we have, unfortunately, is very ionized gas, but it's not exactly in the F1, F2 layer, which is the best place for it for 10 meters. It's been disrupted. Its structural qualities are different than it should be, so it's not acting as a very nice refractor. It's like having a broken lens. The lens will refract light, but once you've broken it, it no longer has the inherent structure to do what you want the light to do through a lens, to either magnify it, to focus it, or what have you. So that's unfortunately the nature that we have a nice supply of sunspots, but we also have the geomagnetic storms, which are disrupting the entire ionosphere.
Roy, where do the magnetic storms come from?
It's a phenomena of the sunspot cycles and the sun's activities, in addition to other things. It spews all kinds of fun stuff. It also spews charged particles. Charged particles produce magnetic fields. You know, going back to early electromagnetic theory, if you have a charged particle at rest, it's just static charge. If you have it going at a steady a pace, it's a magnetic charge. And if you have it going at a accelerated and changing a path, you get an electromagnetic wave induced. So the charged particles are also producing magnetic fields when they enter our atmosphere and produce these geomagnetic storm characteristics and disrupt the ionosphere, because they're charged particles too. So they interact, and their magnetic fields add force and disrupt the structure of these things.
How do they predict these storms?
As far as I'm aware, there's no really good predictive aspect. It's kind of after the fact. Most of the time, especially 3 years ago, we started to have this weird problem where the sunspot numbers were rather high, and yet the propagation was awful. And, you know, I kept on looking at reports of sunspot cycles, and I kept on saying that this is a good day, and I couldn't raise anyone. So I think smarter people kind of went back to their test equipment of the sun and somehow came up with the conclusion that it was geomagnetic storms. I'm sure there's some very, very esoteric way for them to infer geomagnetic storms, but that seems to be the solid excuse that everyone gives me when I ask for the third year in a row why the hell the sunspot maximum isn't giving me good propagation on 10 meters.
Question?
Certainly. Yes, what's your question?
This is 82 to you. So when I check my space weather app, I look at the KP index, and a higher KP index seems to mean the bands are bad. Is the KP index measuring solar storms or sunspots or something different? 82 to you.
I think that solar storms, I don't know if they correlate directly with geomagnetic storms, though.
Understood. Thank you.
You're welcome. Sam, anything else I can help you with?
Roy, Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, of course. Why don't you explain to me, if you don't mind, fusion. What is fusion all about?
Are you talking about radioactive fusion? You're talking about nuclear reactions and such?
Talking about fusion nets.
Oh, okay. You're talking about Yaesu's proprietary digital voice mode transmissions. Which is interesting. They're the only format that kind of lets you flip-flop back from analog to digital. If you use D-Star or if you use DMR, you kind of dedicated to digital. If you set your radios to a frequency and it's not a digital signal, it won't be able to do anything with it. Whereas fusion kind of gives you, you can set it for either analog transmissions or digital transmissions, and you could also set it to recognize it. So in other words, I have a Yaesu radio here that is capable of fusion. If on this frequency someone was to transmit fusion, it would switch over to fusion mode and decode the digital stream. If it received an analog signal, it would decode it using standard FM detection. Fusion is, I don't really perceive it as being terribly different than the other digital protocols. They're all proprietary. They're incompatible. If you have a D-Star handy talkie, you can't do fusion. If you have a DMR, you can't really do fusion with it. You could use hotspots to kind of interface with different modes. And because it has the capability of kind of translating it on the run. So I you know, the only significant difference is the ability to flip-flop between FM analog and digital modes. Otherwise, the range, the sound quality, and what have you, I can't really discern the difference. Some people can. Some people have their favorites, usually people with hearing problems. In the old days, Eric A2EJ had his preferences of what digital mode left artifacts that annoyed him and which left less artifacts. Unfortunately, I tend to find that digital modes kind of balkanize our hobby. They kind of leave people in little islands where, you know, if you invested in a Yaesu, then you used fusion. If you invested in a in an ICOM, you used D-Star, and otherwise you bought a Chinese radio that did DMR. And they all went off on their own little island, separating us even more than we were before. Sam?
Well, I guess my next question is, explain to me, please, DMR. What does that refer to?
Okay. DMR is another digital voice protocol that's incompatible with the others. Its origin is in the United States, I believe Motorola patented it and used it as a commercial communication software. So it's not terribly amateur radio friendly. There's no real place to put your call sign. It requires a unique identifier, and you have to kind of supply your own database to maintain that identifier. So There's a group of guys in the Bronx that maintain a ID radio ID list. You contact them, give them a couple of particulars of your license, and they will give you a ID number that you can enter into your DMR machine. They all kind of use these somewhat confusing different code plug type of phenomena in which, again, because DMR especially was not designed with hams in mind, it was designed more for businesses, and you would hire a guy and pay him a salary so that he could bother to figure out how to put in code plugs. Usually, DMR radios, the first code plug you use is a friend shares his with you. You could use hotspots, so in a way you can kind of melt together the different digital protocols. There are backbones. The DMR has a backbone from the guys who Brandmeister, I think, who are the ones who keep the radio IDs in the Bronx, and other backbones have been developed through the years and gateways, and nowadays everything is very complicated. There are a lot of they're called talk groups. The linked collection through a internet backbone is called different things, unfortunately, for each of these digital protocols. D-Star, they call them reflectors. Fusion, they call them rooms. And DMR, they call them talk groups. So you might hear of people talking about USA English or worldwide English. That's a talk group. LimeArk has a talk group. So you can go dial into your hotspot and select Brandmeister and select LimeArk, and you can listen to the LimeArk repeater through that. You dropped off the repeater.
Do you copy me now?
Yes, I do.
When you talk about digital, are you talking about pure digital communication, or is there a conversion of voice to digital to voice? I mean, what do you mean? How does digital come into play in terms of communication?
Okay, AC2GS, by the way. It starts as analog. You talk into your microphone, it produces an analog signal. Now, unfortunately, if you were just to digitize it, the bandwidth would take up a significant portion of, say, a VHF band, and the FCC would be very, very upset with everyone. So instead, what happens is we digitize and compress the audio through something called a encoder decoder, or better known to some people by the word codecs. There is a company called Ambi, which has a chip and an algorithm that they've patented, and they charge everyone to do anything with it. And that's there are two versions of the Ambi chip that are used in digital modes. D-Star uses the older version, and DMR and Fusion uses the newer chipset. And so they're digitized from the audio to a digital collection of phonemes. They actually can kind of comb through the digital stream and extract out the individual word phonemes into a much smaller, more compressed digital stream. And that digital stream is used to modulate a signal, usually using some derivation of phase shift keying. All of these voice modes use a slightly different type of phase shift keying, which again is not compatible with each other. But phase shift keying is probably the easiest to embed digital stream information. It's also what is done on cell phones, because cell phones are basically a digital mode, as opposed to frequency modulation, amplitude modulation, or single sideband, which is better suited for analog type of original signals.
analogy to a cell phone was very good. It explains a lot about how these things work. To change the subject, chirp. I'm buying some cheap Chinese radios, handhelds, and one uses chirp to transfer information, and the other one does not. Can you explain what chirp is, please? Thank you, Roy.
Yes. AC2GS, just in case I forget. Chirp is a piece of freeware. Some very nice people wrote the software and maintain the software. It's not quite as polished as RTS Systems because RTS Systems make some money selling it commercially, and so they have more time to kind of polish these things up. But Chirp is a decent free piece of software that if you can supply the programming cable and get a reasonably good programming cable. There are pirated chip programming cables that are, you know, they'll charge you $5-6, but you got a 50-50 chance of it working. So, you know, if you see a $5 programming cable versus a 15 or 16, you know, splurge and get the 15, 16 because it's more likely not to be a pirated chip. Using that type of a programming cable, Chirp will allow you to read and write the programming. You know, once again, you get, if it's DMR or D-Star or Fusion, it's more complicated because it's phone plugs and so they're a little bit more difficult to program. But if it's a regular FM analog Chinese radio, then it's just like the software for other radios. They just want you to put in the frequency, the shift, the PL tone, you know, things like that. There isn't any kind of weird esoteric requirement like DMR phone plugs have. So sometimes you need to kind of ease Chirp into working. Sometimes you can't just plug in your radio and try and push the programming in. Sometimes you need to kind of receive the file from the handy talkie itself, and that kind of it helps settle some things with the handshaking between the computer program and the handy talkie. So it may not just work out of the box. You may have to kind of try a little bit, give and take, before it starts to operate. And, you know, you may have to update your software, because there are probably a lot of different sources for Chirp on the Internet, and some are newer than others.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, Sam. That's interesting because one of the radios that I'm getting says it will copy from another matching transceiver, but it doesn't have Chirp built into it, which means you have to hand enter the stations or the networks that you want to work. The other one, of course, works with Chirp, and I guess that'd be an easy download of many repeaters. Back to you, Roy.
Well, the handy talkies themselves, they don't have Chirp on them. Chirp is a PC, or I think it might even be the Macintosh version. But Chirp is a free piece of software. You download, you install it into your computer, and then you plug the programming cable in and try to handshake. And once you get a connection, you could either upload or download the file to the handy talkie. You could download from the handy talkie and get what it was programmed with originally, and if you want to, you could change some of the settings and then re-upload them, or you could just find a file someplace else and just erase the original and just upload a new more local. You know, a lot of the different organizations maintain a couple of phone plugs for different types of radios that, you know, you could ask around for this particular model for the New York City area, and eventually you'll find someone who has a copy, because it's very, very common to share those types of things. If it's just a vanilla FM handy talkie, it's probably not worth the effort. You just should start from scratch. You know, collect your repeater stations that you like, the frequencies that you use, or simplex if you use that, and just type it in. The beauty, again, I don't want to sound like I'm doing ads for these guys, but RTS allows you to cut and paste these types of things between different models. Each model, unfortunately, you have to pay for a different piece of software because they're modular. But, you know, once you have it for, you know, Handy Talkie A and Handy Talkie B, you could cut and paste all of the repeater lists on A and copy them over to B and upload them to your HT.
Thank you, Roy. That's about it for me. I'll be listening this evening. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good, Sam. Always a pleasure. Thank you for participating. This is AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any questions, comments, or topics for tonight, please hit that push to talk and ID yourselves.
KB2ABC, John, Kid Call Flower, listening in, boy. Good evening.
Hello there. You got any questions tonight?
No, nothing at this time. I just copy in the mail. I know you don't take questions, but I just want you to know I'm out of it. Just say hello. Back to next.
Okay, very good. If you ever have a question pops into your head, let me know. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net, and unfortunately, I think Middle Island is down tonight. I'm looking at the indicator, and it's just it's red, and it says connecting. It's been connecting for the last hour that I've been seeing it. So, unfortunately, that probably means that. That's why Rich W2BZ called me instead of. Was on the radio. He can't get in because he usually gets in through Middle Island. He should be able to get in through Echolink, but he's not on Echolink. Anyway, if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion tonight, please hit that push to talk.
W2BXO on Echolink.
Yes, Frank.
I got something that actually is kind of interesting. LDE, long delay echoes. You heard of that before?
Yes, we talked about it before. You mentioned that you had a professor who had a theory of what might be causing it.
I'm not sure, since I wasn't a physics major. I don't think I knew any professors who had a theory on it. Now, anyway, I actually think I heard one last night. Heard several on 14240 calling, I think it was Bravo Golf Zero, Delta Leaf Lima Alpha. I think it was in China about this time last night, and I heard part of my call sign come back to me. I'm like, who's screwing around there? I heard part of somebody else's call sign echoed, and I'm like, wow, that's interesting. I've heard that happen, but I've never heard it before. I mean, it's possible somebody was screwing around with a digital tape recorder, but it's sounded like legitimate LDEs to me. Go ahead.
Ah, that's fascinating. I don't think anyone definitively knows what causes it, but that's real spooky. I mean, I haven't really experienced that, and even kind of stories are more guys have written them down and published them in magazines and such. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of what used to happen with phone freaks. They would kind of capture the telephone company's internals and wrap a telephone line around the world to the next telephone booth next to them. And they would talk into one, and they would get the long delays, and finally would come out the other telephone booth.
Yeah, well, that's easy enough to explain. That's because in those days, most of those overseas connections were done through geosync satellites, so you had the very long delays. I remember one or two times I did overseas calls in those days. I remember hearing that, and I think that since most overseas voice calls fiber optic these days, so they're probably mostly VoIP anyway. How often do you do a real overseas twisted pair call anymore? You know, that's probably not as common as it once was. But this is really interesting, I know you can get an LDE with a really big station, but I was using a station, a remote ham radio site in Connecticut, runs 100 watts to a dipole with a flex radio. I mean, it is possible, I suppose, that it was, you know, another possibility I thought of was that this is an artifact produced in the flex radio. I can't rule that out definitely, but I don't think that's the case either, since I heard it on somebody else's signal also. I think the delay and also the coherence of it led me to believe it was not a case of packet loss, and some of my packets coming back from the remote site a bit late. I don't know enough about this to rule that out definitively. And what I heard, it did not sound like either packet loss or some artifact of the radio. Or go ahead.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, that was actually me that had that in the previous discussion of long delay echoes. It was an instructor I had at City College. He said that it was due to some kind of conversion in the ionosphere of the RF into, I think he called it cyclotron waves or something, that propagated much slower than light, and then a conversion back to RF. What you were hearing was the delay due to the much slower propagation time of these cyclotron waves. I'm not a physics major, so I'm not sure what that is. But it's some type of very slow propagating wave that occurs in ionized matter, which can do a lot of strange things. But I remember we had this discussion a year or so ago.
Okay, very good, John. Yeah, I knew I had the conversation. I wasn't 100% sure it was Frank, but I thought it might be Frank. But I don't know. I mean, once you kind of introduce the fact that this is not a direct RF communication, and you're going through the digital domain, digital signals can get screwed up in so many different ways. I mean, I've heard a whole bunch of different types of distortion through cell phones. So I wouldn't put it completely past the fact that it's some distortion of the digital signal producing these artifacts. It could be that for the other radio stations, it could have been picked up by the original radio, and it was streamed digitally, so you could get echoes and all kinds of messes going on in the digital domain.
over the air with an analog signal. This wasn't an echo that was occurring in the digital domain. The long delay echoes that I remember hearing about and my instructor was talking about was over the air with analog communication. Of course, I think it was single sideband, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I understand that, John. I was alluding to Frank's representation. He said that he experienced something very similar, but he was operating a radio remotely, and his link was through the Internet.
Yeah, that's correct. That's why, as I said, I would not rule out some kind of artifact, either in the Flex radio, which you may know enough about to rule out, or in the VoIP connection with the website. Anyway, I posted the question to Dr. Tamitha Scobb's YouTube channel in the comments. See if maybe she or some of her followers who know a lot more about this have any thoughts on it. Go ahead.
When did you post that? She's the woman who does the astronomy weather?
Yeah, her brand is the Space Weather Woman. She's a solar physicist. Yeah, I posted it a little earlier this evening, probably about, maybe about 4 or 5 o'clock or so. I don't have it up right now.
Oh, okay. I mean, you know, if you get any kind of good response, please feel free to come back and tell me. I don't know if you're going to get that much of a hit. You might get it through the people who just read the post. She's more of a sun weather astronomy type of person rather than, I think, a electromagnetic wave specialist.
Yeah. Well, she finally did get a ham license a couple of years ago. Covers radio propagation a little more than she used to. But you're right. She's primarily a solar physics person, but I think she's fairly knowledgeable on propagation also. Unfortunately, Pat Cook is not around anymore, as you know.
Yeah. I followed her back in the good old days. She first kind of appeared on Ham Nation. She had sort of a feature that was before she got her license, and while she was on Ham Nation, I guess they kind of said, you know, suggested that she get a license, and she did. Entertaining, informative. Again, I'm not quite sure what they'll make of your experience, but I'm curious to find out. Unfortunately, there's no way to kind of prove or disprove. It's one of those phenomena that comes and goes and isn't particularly repeatable on demand.
It's not. It's pretty rare. I believe it when it does happen. I think it's most well known about this point near the peak of the sunspot cycle and near Gray Line, within an hour side of sunrise or sunset. So it was kind of the right time of sunspot cycle, time of night for it to happen. And, I'm thinking, I guess, another possibility somewhat similar to the cyclotron wave kind of thing. I don't really know what that is. It's something called ionospheric waveguide propagation, because I believe, and one of the VHF, UHF types here probably knows a lot more about this than I do, I believe that signal can be delayed by bouncing around in waveguides rather than following a straight path. Go ahead.
Okay, well, then that begs the question, what kind of specific requirement optimizes for those kind of somewhat lateral reflections as opposed to just a simple refraction? I would imagine you would need a much more complicated functional conduit to produce that type of effect.
Yeah, well, ionospheric waveguides supposedly occur, I guess, as well coincident with meteor showers, like, you know, this